Okay, welcome to Wrapping the Gospel. Does everyone have an outline? Good. Let me begin this way. Europe has become a hip-hop nation, or so the Lyon Dance Biennial, one of the world's foremost dance festivals, has been announcing in its annual gala openings, which in the city of Lyon in France have an exuberant showcase for French as well as Central and even East European break dancers. Last year, more than 4,000 viewers, mostly young people, repeatedly stamped their feet in approval in a sports stadium. Renaud Donnedieu de Vabre, the cultural minister, in attendance with Gérard Collomb, the mayor of Lyon, told journalists that hip-hop is part of our heritage. Now, this widespread phenomenon of hip-hop and rap culture is quite extraordinary. We were in Hong Kong not long ago, and there's a whole sub-genre of Chinese hip-hop. Of course, hip-hop originated in the streets of Los Angeles and New York, but now it can be found literally everywhere in the world. And some would say that rock and roll music is basically finished, and hip-hop, emo, many other forms are just taking its place. Now, one of the oldest missiological questions we can ask is how to contextualize the message without compromising its truth and power. I'm trying to think, get my own outline. If you think of Paul's declaration about freedom in relation to this question, how can I become all things to all people that by any means I may win some, but without crossing a line into compromise? Or to put it in another way, what kinds of redemptive analogies may I find in a particular culture that provides a helpful background for preaching the gospel, specifically into that culture, without giving in to the non-Christian worldview of that culture? Rap was born in the streets of New York. It's full of self-assertion and anger. Think of the names of the artists: Public Enemy, Ice-T. What does this have to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Is not hip-hop culture simply the world? Aren't rap artists just anarchists? And we need to address them with admonition, not the message of God's love. Some rap is indeed anarchistic, but there's a surprising variety within this whole genre. And it would be a mistake to lump it all together. Besides, a closer look reveals tremendous analogies with the gospel. If we look to opportunities and to contexts in which to speak the gospel into the hip-hop world, we will find them, sometimes in surprising sources. One of them goes deep back into African-American history. Why don't we go to the next one? Forget how I've done this. Okay, how about the next title? Yeah. Let's see what the subtitle is. Yeah.
Good.
Most of us in this room, all of us in this room, are not African Americans. But let's look briefly into black history, and then we can apply it across the board. Excuse my American examples here, but let me start with a question. What makes Bill Cosby, Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, and Slappy White so different in their styles, yet distinctively black comedians? Why do black musicians, from Louis Armstrong to Dizzy Gillespie to N.W.A., Niggas with Attitude, combine antics with clowning and serious artistry? Why did O.J. Simpson and Tupac Shakur draw so much sympathy? It's easy to misunderstand this posture in a racial way. What these folks bring to us has often become common property. It happens that much of the hip-hop culture, originally from black experience, is now simply urban and even worldwide. It's across the board, not tied to one ethnic origin. But one tradition did develop from American history, Afro-American history in particular, and that is the trickster personality. Let's try the next one. I'm going to raise this up a little bit. The musician's going to hate me for this. No, can't do it. Never mind. As I get older, this isn't good. This isn't good. Nothing's good. Does the top one go up? Thanks.
Oh, very good.
That's perfect. Thank you very much. This is old technology. At one level, an African American is simply a survivor. Belonging to an oppressed group, you find recognition in the entertainment world and maybe in the world of sports. And while you may need to please the crowd with exaggerated frolics, underneath, you develop your freedom to exist. But at a deeper level, the dialectic allows you to be secretly, clandestinely creative. Last night, I talked about the black codes that forbade dancing in Congo Square. And so, in a counter move to this, Africans came up with a sort of non-dance movement. It's legal, but it's beautiful. Duke Ellington, as I mentioned last night, accepted the otherwise humiliating genre of jungle music when he was at the Cotton Club. But he, at the same time, developed extraordinary artistic skills in the medium of jazz. One of the defining trickster characters in African-American experience was the so-called bad black. The real word for it is the bad nigger, but we don't use that word much anymore. But that's what he was known as in the 19th century. On the surface, he was a threat to the surrounding legitimate society. He was free to defy his oppressors with unruly behavior. The blues singer Will Shade made it sound attractive as he sang about packing up his suitcase and starting off to the train. Hey, black folks, that is evil, do anything you want to do, he said, or he sang. The bad black could thus defy his circumstances and improve his lot in life. Yet, as John Roberts argues in Trickster to Bad Man, he was not a bad person in any traditional sense. His goal is neither destructive, certainly not criminal, nor deviant. He's a sort of hero because he's able to challenge the solidarity required for white dominance to succeed. Even today, we use the word bad to mean good. In jazz, for example, if somebody after one of my concerts comes up and says, "Man, you is bad," that means I was great. So this has a long and rich history. One more. In the 1890s, at the end of the 19th century, during what Americans call the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, the bad man was the hero that most inspired the African American community. He could trick the sheriff and outwit the judge. He could manipulate his adjudicators and defy their laws. Singers and storytellers attribute near supernatural powers to this trickster, making him into a magician, a conjurer of freedom. Now, one of the greatest of such heroes was a certain Railroad Bill. No relation. He was a character who seduced another man's wife. And minstrels who sang about Railroad Bill would often personalize the story. They'd have Railroad Bill try to steal away their own woman. Will Bennett, for example, sang a blues about Bill seducing his wife. And that justified Bennett's promise to go on a rampage of revenge against everyone that ever betrayed him. The singer here out-tricks the trickster. Now, of course, Christians should not approve all of this. But perhaps they should keep in mind that in an oppressive environment, the good guy might appear to be the bad guy. Jesus, you'll remember, was often considered to be the bad guy in his ministry. You remember when he first came to Nazareth and he preached the first great New Testament sermon based on Isaiah. He was at first much revered and much respected and much loved, and they loved hearing his message, until they understood that he was criticizing them because the prophet said, "The good news is preached to you because the blind see and the lame walk and so forth." And they realized that they weren't doing this. As if it weren't clear enough, Jesus himself criticized them. And so then they tried to stone him. He was the bad guy. Why? Well, because, as I was arguing this morning in another seminar, he was a sort of good, subversive person. He was bad because he was good. What do I mean by this? Much in hip-hop culture goes back to subversion. You could say that there's even a subversive lifestyle involved. Unfortunately, much of it is purely negative, and it's angry, and it's seditious. And in the last 5 to 10 years, it's become even stranger because many people who live the hip-hop lifestyle have become rich, wealthy people, and they have rival gangs of wealthy people driving the greatest automobiles and having the most number of friends and so forth. So that's a sad tale. But let's not go too fast. Subversion has its good side. If you're trying to win someone's trust, what do? Well, you pose as one of them. In Jesus' case, he not only posed, but he became a man because he wanted to win us over by his love. That's what I call good subversion. The gospel came to the slave community in North America in a number of different episodes, and I talked about this a bit last night. When African Americans learned about Jesus, They saw in him a redeemer, a defender, a friend. And he was willing to become a slave for his people's sake in order to deliver them from slavery. Of course, he was sinless, which none of his people is. But he was willing to become one of us, tainted with our misery and our dirt. Although rich, for our sake, he became poor, so that we, by his poverty, might become rich. Jesus is a storytelling bad guy. He was a master storyteller. He explained many of the deepest gospel truths through parables and narratives and using powerful illustrations. Sometimes he was tough on hypocrites. "Whose face is on this coin?" he said to the people who were trying to trick him into saying you should or should not pay taxes to Caesar. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores. He said to an audience of rich people who cared not for the poor, "Woe to you, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside there's greed and self-indulgence. Do not think that I've come to bring peace on earth, but to bring a sword." Do we not have a sort of rap singer here? Think about it. Now, neither the blues nor rap music sound like Christian music at first. The great writer Ralph Ellison talks about singing to keep the painful details of a brutal experience alive. And he talks about the blues. As a form, he says, the blues is an autobiographical chronicle of personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. But take another look. In the catastrophe is often a redemptive element. Preaching the blues and using the blues to describe life's injustices is actually a prophetic move. The blues tells a story, one that would make no sense in an amoral world. Let's take another look. And I'll give three examples here. One pretty brief, a couple of them a little longer. In the 1930s, blues artist Robert Johnson was a bad man of mythic proportions. Some thought he had made a pact with the devil, which enabled him to play the guitar so well. If you're a blues lover, you may have the complete Robert Johnson. There's not much of it. And there are books that have criticized this as more of a myth than a reality. Nevertheless, he's a brilliant, brilliant guitarist and lyricist. He had to keep moving around in order to stave off the inevitable payoff, his own death. This story is passionately told in his own song, "Hellhound on My Trail." And he did die mysteriously at the age of 36. Legend has it that he was poisoned by a jealous husband. Now, the story is unclear, but the emerging folklore has it that Robert Johnson triumphed over all his oppressors, even in death, by some sort of conjuration. The deeper truth is the story of one telling the truth in musical love, something like what Jesus did, but without the sin. Let's give a second and perhaps more interesting example. Surely the most popular of the bad good men was Stago Lee. He was hailed by writers from Carl Sandburg to Gwendolyn Brooks, Richard Wright, and James Baldwin. He was celebrated by musicians like Ma Rainey and Sidney Bechet, Bo Diddley, Bob Dylan, The Clash. Stag Ol Lee is a favorite folk hero whose story amounts to nothing short of a defining social drama. Apparently, this original event took place Christmas night in 1895 at the Bill Curtis Saloon on Morgan Street in St. Louis, Missouri. This is a particular watering hole where people came together, and it was in the center of Deep Morgan, which is St. Louis's bad section of town. Today we'd call it the Hood. A group of 20 or so was there having a good time. Billy Lyons was drinking his beer with them, enjoying ragtime music from the piano, when everyone turned around towards the door. Lee Shelton, known as Stack Lee, walked into this place. He was one of the town's exotic pimps, in other words, someone who does the business of prostitutes. He was known, as the other pimps were, as a Mac. Dressed to the hilt with a red vest, dove-colored spats over his shoes, Lee went over to drink and laugh with Shelton. Now, the conversation turned into politics. They got angry with each other. It turned to blows. It all came to a head over the hats they were wearing. Lee Shelton grabbed Billy's derby hat and damaged it. Billy demanded 6 bits, that's the amount of money, for the hat's repair. It was refused. And then he grabbed Stack Lee's Stetson hat, and when he wouldn't give it back, Sheldon hit Lyons on the head with his .44 Smith & Wesson revolver, knocking him to the ground. Lyons got up, pulled out a knife, saying, "I'm going to make you kill me." Shelton aimed the gun and shot him. He stood over the dying man and said, "Hey, I told you to give me my hat." And with that, he walked home. Now, Billy Lyons died. He died in the hospital early the next morning. And so Lee was arrested. And he was taken to the dismal Four Courts Detention Center in St. Louis. But he hired a flamboyant lawyer for a high fee, a famous man named Nat Dryden. He was going to defend him. There had to be two trials because at the first trial, the jury was hung. Ironically, Dryden died before the second trial, his drug addictions and alcohol abuse having overtaken him. Now, no record survives of the second trial. On October 7th, 1899, Stack Lee Shelton was condemned to serve 25 years in the state penitentiary at Jefferson City. Paroled in 1909, he got into trouble again and went back to prison, where he died of tuberculosis. March 11th, 1912. Stag Ol Lee became a folk hero because he was provoked and because Billy, who was a lout, lacked the cleverness of a real man. St. Louis hosted the Republican National Convention in 1896. If you've ever watched one of these on television, you wonder how these Americans do politics. But the Republicans had their national convention then. Originally loyal to the party of Lincoln, the Republicans, by this time blacks felt betrayed by the Republicans, as they often still do today, for various reasons. They'd made a deal with the restaurants of the city to the effect that if the convention were held there, they would allow black patrons to eat their meals in their establishments. Unfortunately, they agreed, and then they canceled, they reneged. Furthermore, Milton Turner, former ambassador to Liberia, told his people that the Republicans had in effect enslaved blacks politically, using their votes, but never letting them hold office. This bad, good man, then, was a crusader against injustice. Rap music has a lot of this in its veins. And before we dismiss it as simply anarchistic, destructive lifestyle, should we not ask, is not Jesus the same bad, good man, only without sin? Third example. And this is quite fascinating for me. Thomas D. Rice. He was a white actor who painted himself with burnt cork and pioneered a form known as blackface. From an English immigrant background in Lower Manhattan, Rice joined one of the first traveling theatrical groups, performing a mostly English repertoire. This is in the 19th century. He often performed Shakespearean roles. He happened on a black folk legend about a runaway slave named Jim Crow. And he discovered the extent of his popularity in African American society. He discovered songs and stories about this impudent, maddening, endearing character, and wrote a series of plays based on the trickster theme. And what he started was nothing short of a popular craze in culture. From the stages of America, his plays traveled to Great Britain, and with great acclaim, some criticized. Audiences were usually of a mixed race. Jump Jim Crow was a song with a dance which gradually morphed into a famous stage performance, including interruptions, comic interludes, and improvised endings. Now, Thomas D. Rice not only sang the song, but worked this one and many others like it into his plays. It's difficult for us today to grasp the enormous popularity of this early black-faced minstrelsy. It certainly was dreadfully racist, people painting themselves black. At the same time, it provided visibility for oppressed peoples by making stereotypes into admired characters. Not unlike the function of the commedia dell'arte tradition, these plays and songs meant some kind of legitimacy to officially forbidden views. There was a great attraction to them across racial boundaries. The social equality because of common human traits and the creative trickster were able to overcome oppression. Many of the plays have a sort of Shakespearean overtone. One of the most popular was called Othello, a burlesque opera. Rice takes the classic dilemma represented in Desdemona's Living Out the Dangers of Choosing Outside the Correct Circle and turns it upside down. Young ladies from New York ought to be able to love others for their own sake, for the sake of love. Accordingly, the Moor and Desdemona have a baby named Othello, whose face was painted black on one side and white on the other. But unlike the original tragedy, Othello ends happily for everyone, except Brabantio, representing the state governor. Iago is less an evil man than a social necessity. Like Jim Crow, Othello has learned both to live within the system and to rise above it. as many have suggested, the imitation of perceived blackness, literally and metaphorically, is at the essence of what it is to be an American. This is because slavery is the central trauma of American life. For the moment, we are still Othello with dual colors. We feel guilty. We laugh at the trickster, but we ignore him. We accept the stereotype, but we dismiss the issue. But it doesn't have to be this way. In the earliest American minstrel shows, stereotypes were created not so much out of racism, but so that audiences would laugh at them and go beyond them. Ralph Ellison used to say, "Change the joke and slip the yoke." Now, I don't mean to leave out other races. Asian Americans, Latinos, Irish and Polish, and just about any other group, not to forget Native Americans. But this hard tension was particularly powerfully exhibited in the drama of the life of African Americans. Now, the trickster is but an imperfect Messiah. The true Savior, Jesus, forges true equality because he atoned for our racism. He brought down the barriers. The God-man, the creator become outsider. He is the architect. He is the archetype of which the trickster is an earthly simulation. Humiliated like a slave, powerful like the conjurer, Jesus Christ is the author and finisher of true liberating faith. We learn a lot more about his person and work from Jim Crow. And then, by a sort of good foolishness, the foolishness of the cross, we take his healing and his justifying power into a broken world. Now, last night I talked a bit about the blues. One of the great specialists is a scholar named John Michael Spencer. He goes so far as to argue that black ballads were not simply sinful tunes, and certainly not the devil's music, but they were reflections on theodicy, the problem of God's relation to evil in the world he created. And against the views of certain, mostly white scholars, Spencer understands the African-American folk ballad to be profoundly theological. In some ways, the blues are very close to spirituals. Blues are preached. They're like wisdom literature in the Bible. They identify the problem of mankind with the fall and sinful rebellion. The blues singer is a sort of prodigal son looking for justification. But he will not blame God for the bad luck we have here on earth. Something can and must be done. I didn't build this world, but I sure can tear it down, sings Pleasant Joe in Sawmill Blues. John Michael Spencer believes that there's a close parallel between the blues and a biblical theodicy. The real problem is not God, the white racist, but man, the white oppressor, who looks very much like the devil himself. Jesus, he maintains, was a singer of the blues. Now, my point is that hip-hop is the heir, albeit a distant heir, of these traditions. Sadly, of course, a good deal of secularization has set in. So the art form of hip-hop is more distant from Christian roots than the blues. In the film Played, A Hip-Hop Story, a man named Jazz is the rising rap singer who ignites a bi-coastal turf war. On the surface, it's just chaos. But a closer look shows that Jazz is a prophetic figure who's looking for truth. In Hip Hop Story, The Movie, we live through the tragic murders of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G. But through the violence, we understand that there is still a moral quest. Some of the scenes in these films are horrific, but the question, what would Jesus do, is as relevant here as anywhere. Surely one of the answers is he would lead the protest, though not in anger or violence of an unbridled sort. During the early 1960s, Stago Lee became, as it were, visible. The civil rights movement in America was underway, and gradually, whites-only signs were removed from water fountains and hotel lobbies. Musicians such as James Brown, Wilson Pickett, and the Isley Brothers recorded versions of the story that reflected new power among black males. Cecil Brown reminds us of the form of storytelling known as the toast, where the performer inhabits the hero's character as he tells the story, often not even with any musical accompaniment. The ancient form came into its own in the 1960s, enabling young black men freely to assert themselves as bad men and tricksters. The toast is often in rhyming couplets, each line having four strong stresses. And I'll give you some examples of this at the end. It also draws on an African-American ritual of insult, using the theme, "Don't you know who I am?" Now, the protagonist of such a toast is almost always a bad black, the consummate trickster. In mainstream contemporary hip-hop, the language becomes more explicit, and sadly, often the humor gives way to a mean spirit. There's also plenty of materialism. I was mentioning earlier the lifestyle of some of the rappers, way over the top. Rap certainly qualifies as a toast narrative. The violence and rebellion of the hip-hop culture understandably worries many audiences. But when you factor in the Stago Lee background, you can better appreciate the meaning of it and even glimpse a redemptive element here. This is why Christians have been able to embrace the style and preach the truth in love through it. And again, I'll give you a bunch of examples of that if we can get the sound system to work in a minute. In the unsettling genre known as gangsta rap, the first-person narrative is essential. Rappers can enter into the character and act against the surrounding evil. The gang is the natural audience, not unlike the audience in the Bill Curtis Saloon in St. Louis. Instead of spats and a Stetson hat, the uniform of status is now baggy pants, tattoos, and especially the cap turned sideways. It's funny how much this has caught on. We were on the plane in Austria Air from New York to Vienna just 4 or 5 days ago, and there were these cute little Japanese boys with a family coming over to Vienna, and they all had the sideways cap. You know, this is they don't have no idea, I'm sure, where it comes from, but it's very, very popular. Rappers like Ice-T and Too Short inhabit the hustler ethic for modern times. As Cecil Brown points out, for people left out of the American dream, life is a hustle. Too Short's cars and girls and fashion statements represent the new Max. He apparently was inspired by the 1971 film by that name, in which everyone was and everything are manipulated to serve his purposes. But it doesn't have to be this way. There's another story, and the character can still act against evil without caving in to anger and materialism. Despite the great faults and compromises with the system, with devastating results, The Christian faith, which came to the black community in various ways and at various times throughout and beyond slavery, provided a great ideology of resistance, but also the candor to recognize that sin is an equal opportunity disease. It even revealed the reality of the grace to enable forgiveness and healing to overcome the understandable hatred. Indeed, there's a fascinating trickster element emerging from a specifically Christian African-American culture. In a famous line from Ralph Ellison's Juneteenth, a protagonist is asked, "Hickman, are you a minister? Are you a minister man or a minstrel man?" And the answer is, "I'm both, I'm afraid." And then he adds, "But remember, the word is tricky." Now, many accounts are surfacing which make a direct connection between the gospel as a power to resist injustice and the subversive traits of the trickster. Robert Henry was a Scottish missionary who arrived in Cub Creek, Virginia, in the mid-18th century. To quote the biographers, his besetting sin was an exciting levity in others by his humor and eccentricity. As pastor of the Presbyterian Church, his vehement manner and vein of humor rendered him peculiarly acceptable to the African race, among whom he gathered many converts. This phenomenon was observed by Samuel Davies, whose efforts among the slaves in Virginia during the Great Awakening are quite remarkable. Christian slaves often learned how, as I would put it, to undermine the system by a surface compliance with its rules. As they imitated the Robert Henrys, they moved beyond him and raised the trickster to a new height. Sometimes this was done through humor, sometimes with deadly subversion. Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King Jr. come to mind. How do we reach the hip-hop culture today? Surely, it's no longer only a black thing. We have British rap, French rap, Asian rap. I was mentioning the Chinese. In Hong Kong, Jin the MC is rapidly becoming the most popular singer in Asia. Jin says that hip-hop is more in tune with what's going on with youth in terms of angst and animosity, curiosity, rebelliousness, and everything else. Now, to me, interestingly, it's a bit softer and less violent than the American counterpart. But let me throw out a challenge. If you might be an Asian, or you might be a white, or you might be a Latino, and you have a burden for your teenagers, why not appreciate Ellison's challenge? The minstrel and the minister are not necessarily at odds. I'm both, I'm afraid. But remember, the word is tricky. It's okay to learn to tell the story in rap. Not everyone is called to become a rapper, but everyone is called to become all things to all people. And this includes recognizing the resources of hip-hop for the purpose of evangelism. You can be bad in order to tell the good news. You see, God loves us so much that he's willing to become one of us, to take on our angst, animosity, curiosity, rebelliousness, and everything else, though without sin. Jesus is a friend of sinners who hung out with tax collectors and prostitutes. He told stories, many of them like the toast, some of them violent. He was real. He was authentic. He showed tough love. Why not in our ministries, particularly if you're called to a place maybe in the inner city where the hip-hop culture is widespread, to show the same kind of tough love? Well, back to our very first question. How can I be all things to all people? How can I use a culture's redemptive analogies without giving in to the non-Christian worldview of that culture? Well, I can be in the world, but not of it. I can be like Jesus. I can draw from his example and call the power of his spirit. And in terms of hip-hop culture, I can recognize not only is this one of the many cultures of the world to penetrate for the gospel's sake, but it has a history which makes it in some ways particularly propitious and analogous to the Christian message. We can build analogies. We can find a point of contact because of its history. Admittedly, it's gone very far into the anger and rebellion side of things, but that's not the end of the story. Now, I don't know about Europe. I know a little bit, but not much. But I do know that in America, we have a number of remarkable ministries that have specifically responded to the needs of hip-hop culture. We have some of them that are basically focused on trying to reach out to young people who are caught up in the hip-hop culture. And I think that's one approach, one important, legitimate approach to get the message across. Much as Paul asked Timothy to become circumcised to reach out to the Jews, so these ministries are asking us to become hip-hop conscious in order to reach out to the hip-hop culture without compromising the gospel. But another and perhaps deeper and perhaps more important way to reach out is to see that our churches or our evangelistic outreaches are inclusive of hip-hop people. This does not mean hire a youth minister who wears his baseball cap sideways. That's kind of a tokenism. That's kind of what, that doesn't really reach out. That just says, okay, we paternalistically approve of you and we'll go on doing what we are supposed to do. What it does mean is asking a two-way sacrifice. We're asking the people of God who may be white, middle class, to admit that their culture is not the only legitimate culture and to embrace or at least to discuss and dialogue with parts of hip-hop culture and make that part of the church. We're also asking people who come out of the hip-hop background not to disdain the white middle class, but to respect its histories and traditions and to integrate into that. In other words, we're looking to complete the body of Christ with all the different parts. The hand cannot say to the foot, I have no need of you. The hip-hop person cannot say to the white middle class, sorry, I don't need you, you're the bad guy. But the white middle class cannot say to the hip-hop person, sorry, I have no need of you. That would be to violate one of the amazing phenomena of our time, which is the tremendous growth and spread of this extraordinary subculture. The hip-hop culture can also help us to recognize some of the injustices of society in ways that we may not see because there are just invisible barriers to seeing them. And so as we come close to hip-hop young people and sometimes not so young people, it helps us to open our eyes to what's wrong, to what needs correcting. Yes, it also awakens our zeal and our anger against their injustice, because much in the rap culture is angry, anti-authority, hateful of parents, police, you name it. Much of it is, strangely, because of its origins, affluent and materialistic. This is awful, and we've got to help them see through that. But there is still a bridge to be built. There's still something real there. There's still some a history to draw upon, and some of it's quite a bit of fun. Now, I'm going to ask Ben if he could take the time to see if he can get the sound thing to work on. I have a sample tape of Christians in hip-hop. And while he's doing that, let me just say one thing and then get some discussion going. It is amazing how much this genre, because it is so narrative and hard-hitting, can be effective to get the gospel across. We have a dear friend in Chattanooga who's a marvelous musician who has done things like put the books of the Bible to rap and goes around the streets of Chattanooga talking and singing and speaking to the young people and getting them to learn this rap song where he goes through the whole Bible, all the books of the Bible. He has one on the Ten Commandments. It's entitled Love Command. And he teaches very strong Christian moral principles, biblical principles, principles of grace and redemption, using the rap genre. His name is James Ward. And there are many, many others. There's Cross Movement. There's many other ministries. If you like, I can show you some of the ones that are going on in the States. And counterintuitively, many of the leaders of these movements, which are strongly qualified by hip-hop, are extremely astute theologically. Not too long ago, I guess it was last fall, we had a conference at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia called Contextualizing the Gospel, and it was co-sponsored by our Student Missions Association and a number of leading rap ministries. And we were astonished at how theologically well-read they were. They could quote, you know, these heavyweight theologians like Bovink and John Murray and so forth.
If Satan comes as an angel of light,
okay,
and he got cats following,
go ahead.
I guess I'm
just bumping. Sure, let it go.
Break bread till it hurts, kids. Satan's guard about walking around, working off smirks, white smirking, berserking. You on your la-la, the red cat pop-up. For most drugs and sex, like, ha-ha, I gotcha. Kids quote songs like scripture to Ricka. You pat him on his hip, ain't like that's my little victor. The addictor, a victor with intents to sift ya. Using your little firstborn sister. She likes misters, older than her. Can't even see the fact that demons holding on her. They stroll over her, her father's the devil. She acts just like him, she was born a rebel. Don't be surprised, parents, open your eyes. You quote raps with him just because nobody fears God. Take shots to oppose him. And exposure, so on your knees, you'll get closure. The pen bled when I wrote this. I know Satan ain't liking it. Come on, I said, the pen bled when I wrote this. I know Satan ain't liking this. John 3:19, the verdict. Light is coming to the world, but men love darkness instead of light. Because their deeds were evil. What do you love? What's your darkness? He's prideful, Jim Holder, men folder. Why you sin, he sin, sin? God's like, I've been told ya. Lawless, but loud, this guy's complete evil. Flash a little money and shine just to deceive you. The deceiver, Beelzebub, Apollyon, got you praying to him, but you're the one he's praying on. That's why I'm rhyming on tracks to give life. He can create nothing, only copy little prototypes. Satan adversary, devil, the slanderer, evil one. Matthew 6:13, please be aware of him. He is powerful, signs and lying wonders. You sleeping on Christ, preparing for burning slumber. Resist him, please, saints, draw nigh to God. The father of lies, lies to us. We sin from pride, the schemer, but trust in a redeemer. Take your first step to Christ, your first.
This is a fellow named Jay Silas. It's called Exposure. It's very simple. That little keyboard thing. If you're not used to this, you may have a hard time hearing the words in the text, but it's a very simple narrative. about the threat of the devil, and it's based on John chapter 3, and it's how the sins of the people are exposed. Comments? Discussion?
Can you give us some analogies that would help us to relate with hip hop culture in order to understand them and make the gospel relevant?
Well, this whole movement of rap music comes out of hip hop culture. The whole hip hop culture begins on the streets of Los Angeles and New York with mostly disenfranchised, unemployed people, and then has moved into becoming really one of the main youth cultures of the world. So when you use the term hip-hop culture, it's a loose, amorphous term or title that refers to a large movement with many, many subcategories. And basically all of this stuff that I've been giving you about the trickster and so forth are bridges you can build. One of the main concerns in good hip-hop culture is for authenticity. That's a word you hear over and over again. Now, it's a double-edged sword because authenticity can bring its own problems, but I think they're looking for something real, which they haven't sensed in the dominant culture. And so I think one of the ways we can reach out is to prove our authenticity to them by, you know, having contact, bringing them into our churches, having them in our homes, having fellowship with them. We were recently out in Los Angeles at a Korean university, and many of the young people at this university have made a self-conscious effort to embrace hip-hop culture. They actually embrace the whole lifestyle, but they're Christians. They're rather conservative, almost fundamentalist Christians. But they believe that they can, by doing this, become authentic enough to reach out to the unbelieving hip-hop people. Break dancing is a small part of the larger phenomenon of hip-hop culture. And there are Christians who have put groups together of breakdancers who illustrate parables and gospel stories and so forth. So I think there are lots of ways of doing it. Perhaps the main way is simply through these narratives. Yeah. I mean, becoming all things to all men needs an awful lot of clarification. When he says all things, he obviously doesn't mean things that compromise the gospel, but he means things that are stylistically different from the traditional sort of Jewish culture that are not necessarily at odds with the gospel. And he may mean not just dress or culinary styles, but rhetorical styles, styles of persuasion. So I think you have to make the difference. I think there's much in rap culture which is highly compatible with the gospel. At the same time, there's much which is highly hostile to it, and we've got to make that difference. There's also a difference between what you do outside of the worship hour and inside the worship hour, which has to be more strictly regulated.
It just seems a bit strange that if I was up in America, I could be an opposite example of someone who would be gay in this culture. I know, who were tired, old lady, who wanted to be all things to all men,
Yeah, just as much as it would be for a hip-hop teenager to pretend he was a retired old person, you know. So, I mean, in the church, we ought to be able to meet halfway and to grow to, in mutual appreciation. This friend of ours, James Ward, who lives in Chattanooga and who teaches kids the Ten Commandments and the like, he's in a church which is about 20 years old. And when they first came to this somewhat difficult section of Chattanooga, but which was inhabited by the middle class largely, they had the enormous challenge of trying to bridge two cultures together, the established middle class and this rapidly emerging sort of youth culture, which had different tastes, different norms, different standards. And what do you do musically? What do you do stylistically? They didn't want so to impose youth music that was convincing to the youth that it would unnecessarily offend the generation that was older and that had been there for a while. At the same time, they didn't want to stagnate or alienate the youth. So they did this very gingerly, very slowly, with lots of teaching and introducing some of the songs that were a little bit pushing the envelope. The older folks at first didn't like most of it, but they had the secret of the success of it. It's a wonderful church today, is that both sides, if I can say that, were so gospel-driven that they said, okay, this isn't what I like, but I can see they love Jesus and they want to emulate gospel truth. So I'm going to go along with it and maybe learn something. And you can't say that they were all converted to falling in love with rap music. They certainly weren't. But they began to embrace some of the easier parts of it and began to see it. And then the youth also started to say, well, you know, these hymns, they're not so bad. These hymns are full of rich content, and I kind of groove with these hymns, you know. So there was and the reason they could do that is because they appreciated the love of the gospel and the older people, and the older people took them in. And so, you know, you can't. And yes, and the leader is a particularly winsome person who is non-threatening and very patient, and that helps a lot. So it's rare, but it can be done. but there are things you can't do because you shouldn't. You cross the lines. You want to hear this next one, and then we can go have a little more discussion? The one about the truth, T-R-U-T-H? Track two, yeah. This is called The Teacher. I won't do all of it. It's long. Sorry. Skipping thing.
Oh, we say no to godlessness. Hasn't the grace been given? Haven't we plugged into the God who's got major wisdom? When we pray and we pray for wisdom to make decisions.
We may not get this, huh? Okay. Try the sixth track, The Gospel, featuring R. Swift. See if that's any better. If not, we'll just have to talk. It's not going to work. Okay. There you go.
Yeah. Come on. A living epistle rapping in three person, Godhead Trinity, infinite, endless, majestic, stupendous, representing stupendous. Ministry works as soon as the paper is picked. Kiss and entwine with the force of reading laws of repentance. Man, that computes adds up to a thin list. Trying to get a box to a God, but forgot he was in this. We ain't taking over. The world's been his. It sits in the palm of the God, rocking the signet. Ring for his glory, this king is victorious. We can't remove the
that the king is for his kids. Don't like the truth, but I gotta spit it day. Don't like what I spit, but I gotta live it still. My lyrics build up, put Christ on your conscience. And utilize Christ to spit righteous content. We talk, the gospel be. Then I'll give out the gospel man. Inhale, spit out the gospel man. You're not gonna catch us without the gospel man. We talk, the gospel be. Then I'll give out the gospel man. Versus life. Christ, that's what happens with truth versus death. And in the worst breath, we'll leave you with these lethal rhymes that lead truth. That's the word of God that reads you. Without Christ, you're a corpse walking to the law, while forsaken in the ways of the Lord. Often, with 6 million ways to die, we chose the classic crucifixion style with an open casket. Catch is so dramatic, no need for hope.
This is quite an extraordinary group. They're actually big on the regular charts. They're not just narrowly involved in Christian circles. This R. Swift is the main leader of them, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they have quite an act. I mean, this is just the sound, but if you see them on stage with lights and smoke and stuff, it's quite astonishing. Anyway, further discussion. Yes. Some are quite threatened by it because they've built an entire culture on a sort of image of rebellion and anger and then justified prosperity, so they oppose it. Others are widely and wildly receptive of it. It's amazing how this stuff has actually reached some of the mainstream, and I think one of the reasons is that originally hip-hop strongly cried out for authenticity. And these guys are authentic, and they don't mess around. They're not promiscuous. They're not. And there's a respect for that. Plus, the music is good on rap standards. I mean, it's excellent music. It isn't just sort of Christians trying to sound like, you know, the good guys, but it's really, and there's some possibility, we don't know about this, but there's some possibility that in the next 5 to 10 years, this Christian hip-hop will actually be on the cutting edge, because the other stuff is kind of running out of steam. People are tired of it. It's just, it's degenerate, and it's very hard to get excited anymore about, you know, even Eminem and those guys are running out of attractiveness for their audiences. So who knows? But it's a mixed reception, but remarkable appreciation in many circles, including, of course, the Billboard and the moneyed things, and the, you know, and you go to the record stores. There's a section now on Christian hip hop and or Christian rap in most of them. So yeah, I don't know how it's going in Europe, but that's the way it is in America. You know, I never would have thought so 15 years ago when it started out. It all sounded the same. And to be honest, I mean, still, there's a certain monotony to this. But it is remarkable how resilient it is and how there are, you know, there's diversity within it of sorts. And once you sort of get inside the genre, some of it's quite compelling. We had at the same conference I was telling you about a man get up and do a rap version of Psalm 72, and it was powerful. And it didn't sound anything like, you know, some of the more mainstream rap, but it was definitely rap. So, you know, as a musician, my first impression is, this stuff is all the same. And then you get into it a little bit, and you think, well, no, there's quite a lot here. There's quite a bit of possibility. As I say, it may very well replace rock and roll. I mean, Steve Turner argues that rock and roll is basically dying. I don't know if he's right, but it looks like he may be right.
it seems quite, odd that you would have a secular rap and then this Christian rap as a subgroup, if you like. It's as if you're saying that a certain art or certain cinema is Christian, so isn't it? I think, I guess within rap, I would tend to kind of try and, in some cases, focus on the things that are good within it, that are transcendent. And, Eminem is very much seeking truth and seeking honesty about himself, seeking honesty from other people. His material is, of course, really offensive, but he really, seeks that truth, whereas 50 Cent is. To a lesser degree about truth, but continuing rapping about destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And often in his songs talks about praying at night and these kind of things. So I guess the idea of Christian rap getting momentum is if it's actually just good rap that's willing to rap about life and jobs or violence or justice or whatever, then there's a possibility of that.
I take that point very strongly. I think that's absolutely right. One of the tragedies in rock and roll history is that maybe in the 70s or maybe starting in the 60s, there was a subgenre of Christian rock. And the unfortunate thing about it was blatantly evangelistic, lacked poetry, lacked social relevance, some of it was okay, but it wasn't rock and roll that happened to celebrate life. It was narrowly propagandistic. And I think there's a great danger of this. Now, the slight difference might be that rap to begin with is supposed to be strong propaganda for various social causes. But I do take the point. I think if these folks don't broaden out to commenting on all of life, in a way, you don't want a subcategory that says Christian this or Christian that, because first, Christians should just be the best humans, and second, it's much more easily dismissed if you're a Christian subgroup. So, I think that's a very good point you make, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future. There's a strong intentionality of almost all of this, and some of it is just in your face. You just hope that Christians would be comfortable being prophetic, but about every area of life, and not just narrowly focused on salvation issues, and self-consciously creating a subgenre, and we'll just see what happens. I couldn't agree more. It's time for one more, and then I don't know if there's evaluation forms. Okay, just one more point. Anybody want to make a quick point, or want to hear a last example, or anything like that? Okay. Of you assembled here, how many in the countries that you represent of you would say hip hop culture and rap? Narrative is a significant presence where you come from. Not just listening to things that come from America, but that are present in your own country. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bulgaria,
yeah.
Huge.
Is that right?
Very much so. And actually, I was interested to hear everything you're saying. There's, I think, one or two quite popular Christian rock groups.
Hmm.
And at first, I heard of them about 2 years ago for the first time. And I was very skeptical. I thought it would be foolish and not really good quality. Turns out they're really very popular among non-Christians.
Hmm.
And it seemed that one of the positive sides is they haven't really been very upfront with coming from the church.
Hmm.
They are Christian in their lives, but not bringing up their agenda too much.
Yeah. Interesting.
So
It's amazing just the sheer ability of somebody to put a narrative of 5 or 10 minutes together and just nonstop. I mean, it's, I can see doing that on the piano, but with the voice, I think it's an art that goes way back, and of course people can do it, but it's just quite astonishing to witness that. And I guess it works in any language, right? Bulgarian, English, whatever. Yeah, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically that strong pounding rhythm and the sort of, I mean, there's slight variance. Like this Japanese fellow, Hong Kong fellow, maybe because of what traditional classical Chinese culture represents, he's less in-your-face anti-authority, but it's in Cantonese, but it has that background to it.
When you talk about sampling, what would you say is that? Am I getting obviously to say what the ethics of sampling or how creative to sample all the time? Is the creativity to use the sampling?
I think the sampler can definitely challenge creativity if it's used in the wrong way. One of my quarrels with a lot of tendencies today in music is the overuse of sound producers. Not because that's wrong, there's some wonderful imaginative ways to do that, but because it tends to be reproduced rather than produced. It can be, for many people, just a lazy way of doing things. It's actually harder to be on top of sound producing machines than it is to use them well, than it is to use them as a background, because you have to be totally in control of what's going on. Whereas if you're playing an instrument, you're more directly just producing the sound yourself. Yeah, sound. This is a tough question because we have so many technological possibilities. And as you know, some popular music is simply generated by machines. Very little human function whatsoever. Japanese techno pop, there's very little human element in there, and you wonder where is this going to go, So yeah, I wariness, but not dismissal.
I think that in the UK we have those figures who are taking in response to
good.
I guess we have one great called Golden Age of Chain that's very much a parody of American rap and just potentially just makes fun of it in a very clever way. And then we have one great called The Streets who have taken that whole idea and then slowed it down massively to only actually use the right part and to. But there's more artists at the top of my head, but a lot of it is just a reaction to that, to say, look, this is about art form, but we're not too excited about repetitiveness.
Yeah, right. That's happening in America as well. Yeah, absolutely. So we might pull out of some of that and become more creative. I mean, these genres take time to develop. Now, that's interesting.